This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up, conversation with Lawrence Husick of the Foreign Policy Research Institute's Center for the Study of Terrorism and Cyberterrorism about international security. But first, since January, civil unrest has stirred in the streets of Venezuela. Throughout the country, violent protests have erupted in response to inflation, to crime, and to food shortages, claiming 39 lives and causing countless injuries. The situation has left many wondering what it will take for the chaos to end. The ousting of President Maduro, a new election, U.S. sanctions. One thing's certain, the situation in Venezuela is very complicated. We're going to try to get a clearer picture today on Where We Live. You can join us at 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. If you've been following the protests in Venezuela or the world's response, or if you have ties to that country, we'd love to hear your voice in our conversation. 860-275-7266. You can email wherewelive at WNPR.org, or you can tweet us at Where We Live. Joining us first is Leonor Falcon, who's a native of Venezuela, who left 7 years ago to pursue a music education. She's a violinist who lives in the U.S. Leonor, welcome to our program. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, John, for your call.
I also want to welcome in Juan Mejia, who's a spokesperson for Carlos Vecchio, co-founder of Voluntad Popular and a Yale World Fellow. We're going to be talking more about that political party and about Carlos Vecchio in a moment, but I want to welcome in Juan Mejia, who joins us by the phone as well. Juan, welcome to Where We Live.
Yeah, thank you very much for the opportunity.
Leonor, first I'll ask you, your last visit to Venezuela was in December, just before the protests began. Can you give our listeners a sense of what the political situation is like in the country right now and what you think may have led to the protests that have been ongoing for the last several months?
Well, I do know why people's protesting right now. What I saw in December is something I didn't see before. It's the problem of the scarcity of food, basic food and basic medicines. There are long lines outside every supermarket. You're just allowed to buy one or two rolls of toilet paper or, you know, almost like in Cuba where you have this scarcity problem. The thing with our country is that there's not any justification for this because we're a rich country. We have oil. And now if we dig into it, you can see that we are giving away tons and tons of oil to different countries, mainly Cuba. We're basically financing the Cuban government, Cuban revolution, whatever you want to call it. So right now, and well, we're all guessing that there are also lots of corruption within the government because you can just not explain just like that we just don't have basic need things like, you know, milk
and
flour.
How much has that changed in the last few years as compared to the long rule of President Hugo Chavez, who essentially started this revolution? Have things gone substantially, in your mind, Leonor, downhill since that time?
It has been coming downhill since we have this system of government, but I do feel like at least the scarcity problem has increased a lot in the last year. I try to go every year, and this December was really like I saw this thing that I never saw before. And then the other problem that people is protesting about is the problem of insecurity and impunity. There's 92% of impunity. That means for every 100 crimes that are committed, 92 are not solved at all. So obviously the people that's in the crime business, they know that they're not going to get punished, so they just keep going. We have a very corrupted police system. We have paramilitaries all over the country that are basically ruling the country. They have been armed by the government. That's a fact. It's not, inventing. It's a fact. It's very complicated. Why do we have so much crime right now? But the point is that our government is not doing anything about this. If they are, they're just justifying it or minimizing this problem. And it's a social problem that's affecting every class, you know, like even the very poor person or the very rich person or the middle class person are affected by this rates of crime. You know, it doesn't matter how much money you have. It's just violence rates are really, really high right now. It can happen to anybody.
I want to bring in Juan Mejia and get your take on what Leonor had to say. Do you see these problems, the problems of scarcity, food shortages, the problems of crime as being the main reasons why people have taken to the streets in protest against the government?
Yeah, I mean, I think those are two of the most important problems we are going through right now in our country. Scarcity, I mean, it's an economic issue, and you have a social issue, which is impunity and violence and all. But also, I will add to that you have a political crisis that does not allow us to move on, to move forward, and to solve these problems. I mean, Venezuela is not the only country in the world that has economic issues, and it's not the only country in the world that has social issues. But the difference is right now that we have no political means, no institutions where we can actually try to solve these issues. The assembly, which is supposed to be a space where we can debate the ideas we have, has been almost kidnapped by the party in the government. They have not let opposition congressmen to speak at all. Mayors that have been elected by the people as far as a month ago are being thrown to jail right now without prosecution, without any formal charges. They're just kidnapped by the security police and then sent to prison. Now we have, as long as today, we have two mayors in prison. It's basically a gridlock where you have all these problems, but no means to solve them. And it's basically what has produced this crisis and what has taken us up to this point where we don't see a clear solution to the problem in the near future. We would like to say the opposite. We would like to think that we're going to be able to move on soon, but it doesn't appear to be that way.
We're talking about the ongoing political and civil unrest in Venezuela. And if you want to join us, 860-275-7266. We focused quite a bit on the show in the last several months on the situation in Ukraine, and we're very interested in finding out what's happening here in the Americas as well. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. You mentioned the mayors who were recently arrested. One, the mayor of San Cristobal, a city near the western border with Colombia where the protests started. The mayor, Daniel Ceballos, is a member of the Popular Will Party that you work with, and I'm wondering if you can tell us a bit more about that party, what exactly it represents.
Yes, I mean, it's a new political about 2 years ago. It's made up of mainly young politicians from around the country that want to bring about change. And, for example, this city, which is located near Colombia in the border, it's a city that has a history of opposing the government. It has never, I mean, agree with the national politics. But nevertheless, I mean, they're citizens, they're Venezuelans, but they have been victims during the last several weeks of repression by the armed forces, of repression by paramilitary groups that have been going through the streets killing people. Venezuela amounts right now for more than 40 deaths since the protests began. And I know the U.S. is very concerned about the situation in Ukraine and in Syria, but I don't think Venezuela is that far from reaching such huge violence. We really think the situation is really delicate right now. And, Daniel Ceballos, which is the mayor of that city in the border, was in a meeting in Caracas, and basically, he was kidnapped in the middle of the night by the security police and sent to prison, and he's been there since then. There's not even the possibility of visiting these people that are in prison. Only their close families, their very close relatives can actually access them. But people, I mean, that work with them, people that have people from our party are not even able to see them. Carlos Vecchio, it's another politician, a political leader in our party. He's also has an arrest order right now, and well, he's decided to hide in the country. He's decided not to allow the security forces to take him to jail, and he's been trying to send a message from wherever he is right now. So the situation, it's very delicate.
And again, Carlos Vecchio is a Yale World Fellow. We've spoken with this organization before. Yale World Fellows consist of a number of political leaders, young political leaders around the world, some of whom have been jailed in their home countries for speaking out. As I said before, Juan, we've spoken quite a bit about the Ukraine, and we followed the situation there. One of the interesting things that we see on the ground is that while there is opposition to the government there, there was not one clear opposition party. You represent one of the political parties. Is there a number of factions in Venezuela vying for the lead, I suppose, in the protest movement against President Maduro, or are those various groups working at cross purposes, I suppose, and working against one another?
No, in Venezuela, since at least 7 years ago, we have been able to unite the opposition parties in a unified platform, which is called the Unity Round Table. That institution unites all the opposition parties, and we have been able to coordinate most of our activities through that round table. Of course, as in any democracy, there are different points of view of what path to take, what actions are the most effective ones. But most of the things we do are coordinated, and I think the goals we share are common. What we want in Venezuela right now is to be able to reestablish democracy, is to be able to solve all these economic problems we were talking about, all these social problems like insecurity, like impunity, but through democratic means, I mean, within the Constitution. We've never mentioned any ways that are not inside our national law. But as I mentioned before, that has not been possible, and that's why we're trying to figure out a way to move on and to try to solve this crisis. In the middle of that, hundreds of people have been injured. Thousands of people have been sent to prison. I'm just reading right now, as we speak, an Amnesty International just released a report today in their webpage, accounting for all the violence, and they're worried that we can actually again into a spiral of violence and threat to the rule of law. They mention in this report that as far as today, there have been 550 people injured, 120 of them through use of firearms. And they also mentioned that 2,157 people have been detained during the protests. So it's very complicated situation that we're going through. And we hope that the international community, that the U.S., gets as concerned about what's going on in Venezuela as it's concerned about what's going on in other countries.
We want to get to some phone calls at 860-275-7266 as we talk about the ongoing political and civil unrest in Venezuela. Yaquinto is calling from Greenwich. Hello, you're on Where We Live. Go ahead.
Hi, this is Jacinto from Bona. I'm Venezuelan. I just woke up today to see my sister's message saying that Maria Corina Machado has been defrocked as a assembly woman, basically taking away his immunity as a parliament member. And the thing is, what people don't seem to understand is that there is absolutely no rule of law in Venezuela. There's absolutely no respect for any kind of institution, not even the fake of at least seeming to be any kind of institutional law, rule. So that's the crisis in this country, which has gone on since George Bush was in power, because he was unable to do anything about it. So I mean, and Maria Corina Machado was a person who actually talked to George W. Bush, And nobody was able, nobody has been doing anything about it. And it's very sad for me to see Marco Rubio picking up this fight when it's clearly something that should be a bipartisan issue. Other than that, well, it's not a... I don't see the United States being able to do much more in any case.
I'm wondering if I can just ask you before I let you go, what do you think is at the root cause of this violence? This goes not just back to obviously the George Bush administration in America, but many years back into the previous regime, I suppose, of the former president. This violence has continued for years in this country. What do you think is at the cause of this?
Oh, it's very clearly that it's a regime that has very fascistic roots in terms of a military that rules directly through a ruler connection to its people, and like Mussolini's Italy, they connected to the lowest possible class of people. I mean, namely. People, criminals without any kind of boundaries to social behavior. Mm-hmm. It is a public health crisis, and it's very solvable. It's very possible to solve because Colombia shows it, for example. And we have to invent nothing. We just have to repeat the arduous process that Colombians went through to reduce their criminality. But it was thanks to the previous regime, as you call them. I hope you're talking about Hugo Chavez and not the former democracy.
I certainly was. Sir, thank you very much for your phone call. And Leonor, before we take our break, I'm wondering if you might respond to that. What our caller was suggesting is we've seen the neighboring country of Colombia change quite substantially, become a place where there is quite a bit less violence, certainly still violence, but quite a bit less violence than there was historically for decades. Do you think that Venezuela can in some ways turn that corner, and what would it take to get there?
I think we're on the way there because we do have paramilitaries in the country. We have several types of it. We have what they call the colectivos, which are groups of people, with left-wing kind of idealism. Some of them are armed by the government to defend the revolution, but obviously these are violent people. These are people that every time there's a protest, they go out to scare all the protesters over there, kill, shoot. There's also, you ask him, how come this violent situation has been going on for so long? And I have a theory. I think one of the many reasons is, well, first of all, we had a military president for 14 years. When you have a military person governing a country, they govern it as if it was a war. You need an enemy and you need a friend, and that's what he was expressing in his speeches. It was a speech full of hate, where the other one always had the fault, and whoever dared to say something against what they were doing was, whatever, you name it, like a fascist. They created this word escuálido, which is like for whoever is not with the government. It's like a pejorative word. The same happened in Cuba. Whoever was not with the government, they would call it the worms, the gusanos. And that way you create so much hate in the people, in the population. And then you go and you arm the colectivos, and then you don't do anything about crime rates. And then you don't pay the policemen enough to have a good security system in the country. Right? There are many reasons, but one of them, I think, it's the emotional part of that had the speeches that he gave.
It almost sounds as though what you're saying is, in many ways, it was an attempt to lead a country that was going to naturally be in crisis, that was always going to be warring with itself, that was going to have corruption, and in that way, he was able to control it.
Like if you divide, you will win. You know that. He divided the country, and they won. They have the power. I think the answer now would be for every Venezuelan to just, you know, unify. We are completely separated. We're a divided country.
We have many people who want to join our conversation. We're talking with Leonor Falcon, who's a native of Venezuela, who is a musician here in the United States. Juan Mejia is a political leader in Venezuela who's also in the United States right now, who's speaking to us by phone. We're taking your phone calls at 860-275-7266. We'll get to those in just a moment as we continue our conversation about Venezuela here on Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're talking about the continuing civil and political unrest in Venezuela. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266, and people want to join our conversation. So let's go to Maria, who's calling from Waterford. Maria, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello. Yes. My name is Maria. I have been in this country almost for 40 years. I still have family in Venezuela, and I was in Venezuela on February 12th when the revolution started. It's a very, very sad place to be. It's no food. It's no food for the people. People, they are in line at 6 o'clock in the morning, maybe getting to the top of the line, and it may be no food for them. Our main dish, our main bread is arepas. It's no arepas. It's no money. It's no money. People just don't have no food. There's no medicine. People, there's a big sign in the drugstore. If you have high blood pressure, there's no medicines for you. People are kind to each other, even they're going through this problem. The problem in Venezuela is that they have three different kind of social status. You have the rich, that they're very rich. Then you have the middle class, that they're very small. And then you have the poor, that they really are the ones that are being controlled by the government. And they're happy. They say, well, we're happy. I don't have no problem, you know, because they don't have aspiration. They're not looking for the future of our country. And who is fighting right now is the middle class. And some of the rich people, but most the middle class is the one that is day after day. My family is there, is having very difficult times with the situation because they love the country and they want everyone to be free. I beg everyone to please help Venezuela. We need a lot of help. And the moment we can get help, I think all of us will be free and everybody could be happy.
Maria, let me ask you, what form does that help take in your mind? What sort of help do you think you would like from the United States or from people who are listening here?
Just like you help the other countries, maybe have the United States meet with the government of Venezuela and try to tell Maduro that what he's doing to Venezuela is not helping the people. Is Venezuela is turning to a communist. Let me tell you what they're doing right now. When you go to the supermarket, they take your name and they take your ID card, it's almost like your social security card. And that way they keep track of how much food or what you are buying, and that way they keep track of everything that you are buying. It's all almost controlling their people, controlling our people. What I would like to see is for all the countries in Latin America, sit down and try to come out with some help for my country, something where people can talk, where they will come out with some ideas, help the people to figure out how we can help them. I know Colombia doesn't want to be involved. They said that they really don't want to be bothered with that. And I really, the only thing I would say is all the Latin American countries, even United States, come to the table and try to find a solution for Venezuela. We need help. People are dying. People are dying, not just only because they're being killed, but they're dying of hunger. It's no food in Venezuela. It's no medicine. And I worry for my family, especially my mother, who's going to be 90 years old, leaving the country.
Well, Maria, first of all, thank you very much for your phone call. I really appreciate it. And I wish all the best and safety for your family in Venezuela. Thank you for sharing your story.
Thank you so much, sir.
And if you want to join us in our conversation about Venezuela, 860-275-7266. Here's a bit from NPR correspondent Lourdes Garcia Navarro, who covers Latin America. She's talking about the food shortages in that country.
Álvaro Villarrueda starts his morning the same way every day, putting in a call to his friend, who has a friend, who works at the local supermarket. Today he's looking for sugar, and he's asking his friend if he knows if any shipments have arrived.
No. Era para saber si...
As he's talking on the phone, his wife, Lisbeth Nello, is in the kitchen. There are 10 mouths to feed every day in this family. Five of them are children, and two of the youngest are still in diapers. The things that are the scarcest are actually what we need the most, Nello says. Flour, cooking oil, butter, milk, diapers. I spent last week hunting for diapers everywhere. The situation is really tough for basic goods. As with everything in Venezuela, the reasons given for the food shortages are different depending on your political affiliation. The government says it's the result of unscrupulous businessmen waging an economic war and hoarding by regular people afraid of shortages. Those in the opposition blame a system that imposes price controls, the lack of dollars to buy imports, and problems in the supply chain after the expropriation of farms and factories by the socialist government here.
That's Lourdes Garcia Navarro from NPR reporting on food shortages in Venezuela. That's our conversation today on Where We Live. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. On the phone with us is Juan Mejia, who's a spokesperson for Carlos Vecchio, who's co-founder of Voluntad Popular, one of the opposition parties there. He's Carlos Vecchio is also a Yale World Fellow. We're also speaking on the phone with Elena Falcon, who is a native of Venezuela, who left 7 years ago to pursue a music education. Juan, as you hear that story and also the call from Maria that we just heard, it seems as though this issue of shortage, supply of food is something that's very, very important. I was asking her what she thinks the United States or those listening could do to help those in Venezuela. Juan, what do you say?
Yes, well, I have a couple of comments. First, it is true that the crisis is hitting really hard the middle class and the upper class too. But it's also true that, most of the country, it's doing pretty bad right now. The difference is that some people have the possibility to go and protest in some areas of the country, and some others don't. For example, in many of the slums in our country where most of the poor people live, you have armed groups supported, by the way, by the government that threaten you and actually attack you if you actually protest in those places. So that's one of the reasons why many of the protests have been going on in middle class more than in slums. Second, I do want to clarify too that people that probably listen to the program will say to themselves, well, at least you had elections there. That's an elected government. So, you're going to have to deal with that until next elections. Well, democracy is more than having elections. In a true democracy, in a full democracy, you need to have fair elections to begin with. And then, but you also need separation of powers. You also need to respect minorities. You also need to have freedom of speech. And none of those things you have right now in Venezuela. What good does it do to win an election like some mayors did on December of 2013 if they're going to be thrown to jail without any trial whatsoever? So in Venezuela, I believe the difference right now compared to some years ago is that democracy, it's almost non-existent in the current situation. And finally, regarding to that, what Americans can do, I actually do think that the government has done, an effort to address the issue. They have called international community's attention on what's going on in Venezuela. And as you can imagine, the Venezuelan government always blames the U.S. about what's going on in Venezuela. They say that the U.S. is trying to provoke instability and provoke a coup in our country. So, what I do believe that people can do, it's awareness. It's to know what's going on, to discuss this with your friends, to share whatever photos, videos you can find on Twitter, Facebook. I mean, when I was mentioning that we don't have a freedom of speech in Venezuela, what I'm saying is that we don't even have a TV channel to talk through. We don't even have a radio station to deliver the news. And most of the things that have been going on have, I mean, been going on, and we have known about them through social media, through Twitter, basically. And the government lately has also tried to, you know, ban some issues from Twitter. So I think the best international community can do is create awareness and pressure some of the governments that can actually impact and do a better job at trying to pressure our government. For example, if neighbor countries like Colombia, like Brazil, like Argentina will raise their voices against what's going on, that will make a huge difference. Last week or the week before, we had an OAS meeting, which is the Organization of American States, in Washington, D.C., and many countries in the region actually backed the opposition's claim to have a commission, to have a group.
Hello, Juan, are you there? I think we lost your line momentarily, and we have just a few minutes left in our conversation. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Leonor Falcon, I want to get back to something I neglected to ask you earlier, but I would love to hear just a very brief story from you. We've been talking about violence that's continued in the country for some time and the number of kidnappings that have happened. Back in 2007, you were kidnapped, weren't you?
Yes, I was.
What happened? What happened there, and how common is this?
Well, this is something that's happening every day back home. It's a very common thing. It's, you know, when you say kidnapping, people think about, you know, like when there's this very big, very rich person from a company and they kidnap him for millions and millions of dollars or whatever. But we have this for everybody. If you don't have that much money, they would kidnap you anyway. I was in a bank with a friend. He cashed a check, and he deposited half of it, and then he took the other half and put it in his pocket. And when we went out of the bank, we took a cab, and the cab was going to take us somewhere, but then suddenly he stopped, and three other guys came in the cab. They started hitting my friend, and they started threatening us with guns, and they would... I think they didn't call anybody because we said we were musicians. So maybe they're like, oops.
Because you're musicians, they weren't going to get any money out of you, you're saying.
Yeah, but they would, I mean, they took us for 4 hours. This is a new thing that started happening some years ago there. It's called Kidnap Express. They just take you for a few hours ride, you know. And they would, like, threaten us and take our cards. And, like, if you don't give me your code, you know, I'll kill you, whatever. They just took all the money they could from our cards. And then they, well, thank God they set us free, like, 3 or 4 hours after. You know, and then we talked to, oh, so we went, when we were in the cab, the guy said, where's the money? So my friend gave him the money. And they said, no, but what's the rest of the money? Said, what do you mean? Well, the cashier in the bank told me that you cashed this amount. So, you know, there we knew that the bank people was involved in this. And then we called the police, and a cousin of mine who was in the police at that time, he said, don't go. The police said, you should go to the bank with us, and you tell us who's the guy. And then my cousin that was in the police, he said, no, you know, like, you don't go, because you go, they would kill you, because the police is also involved. So
I'm sorry I have to interrupt because we run low on time, but it's from what you're saying before, as you were telling us this story, Leonor, I was thinking back to what you said about a system that was set up to have people living in fear, and it certainly sounds like a horrifying situation to face, and that you or many others might face something like that in your home country is something that I think many of us need to pay a bit more attention to as we look around the world. I want to thank Leonor Falcon, who's a musician here in the United States, who's a native of Venezuela, who spoke with us about her home country today on the program. Thank you so much, Leonor, for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you, John. Thank you very much for your call.
Thank you also to Juan Mejia, who's a political leader in Venezuela. Thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity.
When we come back from our break, we're going to have a conversation about cyber terrorism with Lawrence Husick from the Foreign Policy Research Institute. How big a problem is cyber terrorism across the world today? We'll find out coming up next, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, Colin McEnroe will guest host our weekly news roundtable, The Wheelhouse. He'll be joined by a panel of reporters to break down the week's news. I hope you can join Colin on the next Where We Live. Over the past few years, many Americans have heard a new term, cyber terrorism. Back in 2012, NATO reported 2,500 significant cyber attacks made against that organization, and crime has extended into the private sector as well. Last year, hackers broke into the retail giant Target and stole credit card information from millions of customers. Tonight, the World Affairs Council of Connecticut will be hosting a conversation on the topic called Fighting Below the Belt, Global Cyber Terrorism. You can find out more at ctwac.org. The main speaker will be Lawrence Husick. He's co-chairman of the Center for the Study of Terrorism at the Foreign Policy Research Institute. He joins us by phone. Lawrence, welcome to Where We Live.
Good morning.
We have heard a lot about cyber terrorism over the past few years in the news, but it's a very abstract idea for a lot of people. When you talk about cyber terrorism, what exactly is it you're talking about?
I'm talking about attacks on the infrastructure of a nation, which go on through the use of computers and networks, principally through the Internet. And when I say infrastructure, I mean everything from our electric power grid to our communications and transportation networks to our banking system. The list just goes on, because everything is connected to computers these days.
What are the trends in cyber terrorism that you're most worried about today? Do they have to do with shutting down of infrastructure, stealing of accounts? What's the biggest worry that you lay up in bed worrying about at night?
Well, I think the biggest worry is that the United States has in the past been very slow to catch on to this trend. And that's not unusual, because 95% of the computers in our country are actually not controlled by the government. They're in private hands. They control our industry. We use them at home. We carry them around in our pockets. And those systems are really not very well protected against someone who is really intent on doing us harm. And so I see a real problem in that we are playing catch-up in this world and doing it quite badly.
How far behind are we? If we're playing catch-up, how far behind are we really in this war?
Well, the nightmare scenario was outlined by the Department of Defense in a report that was published last March. When they analyzed our nuclear forces, what they determined was that we were unable to guarantee that our nuclear systems were safe from cyber terrorism. And furthermore, what they said was that it would take us $500 million and 5 years to be able to say that they were safe. And when they say safe, that means that if we needed to push the button, we can't be sure that the missiles would go up. And even if they went up, we can't be 100% sure that they would come down in the place we intend. And that's pretty scary.
That's very scary. When you talk about being safe or not safe from any type of threat, how much do we know about our ability to prove safety with the ability of computers changing so rapidly and with so many people around the world working at the idea of disrupting through cyber terrorism? It seems as though we may find ourselves thinking we're safe, but then there's some new hack, some new way around that we might not be foreseeing right now. How likely is that?
Well, of course, it's always fairly likely. In the cyber world, we have things that are called zero-day attacks, and those are flaws in systems that we don't yet know exist. And so they can be exploited against us because we have no known defenses. And those continue to crop up, and we continue to put our thumb in the dike like the little Dutch boy. But there are lots of steps that we can take that are safe and effective and, more importantly, cost-effective to give ourselves a much higher level of not only safety, but also of resiliency. And one of the things that we need to be aware of is that whenever these attacks occur, they will be intended to disrupt and not primarily destroy. And so being able to guarantee a level of resiliency by having some backup systems and some spare capacity is always a great way to deal with the threat.
We're talking with Lawrence Husick, who's co-chairman of the Center for the Study of Terrorism at the Foreign Policy Research Institute. He's speaking tonight at the World Affairs Council of Connecticut. It's a conversation called Fighting Below the Belt, Global Cyber Terrorism. If you want to find out more, you can go to ctwac.org. Do you see the biggest threat from abroad being other states or other individuals or some sort of combination, a network that's somewhat like the cyber terrorism version of Al-Qaeda?
Well, it's really a combination of both. We have seen the greatest organized threat come, of course, from the People's Liberation Army in mainland China. They have an entire effort devoted to cyber, and we have localized that, found out where it is. It originates from a single large building in Shanghai. But then there are other loosely affiliated groups, such as the Qassam Cyber Fighters and the Syrian Electronic Army in the Middle East. There are the hacktivist groups like Anonymous and the others of that ilk. And then there is organized crime. And all of these things are a very fluid nexus that moves in ways that are very difficult to map and pin down. And at times, some groups organize and are funded by governments, and at other times, they're simply freelancing.
This idea of that you raise around Anonymous, say, or that some people, as they're listening to this conversation, might be thinking around WikiLeaks or Edward Snowden, sort of gets to one of the perhaps differences between what we'll call cyber terrorism and the traditional terrorism that happens against persons, people with bombs or guns. It's that in cyber terrorism, there may be people working to disrupt, but for a much wider variety of reasons than what we traditionally see someone blowing up a bomb for. For instance, the folks behind the leaks of the NSA documents are essentially trying to point out something about the American government and the way it operates. Do you view this in the same way as you view an attack from the outside from say, China?
Well, I don't really view it in the same way at all, because I really don't view things like WikiLeaks and what Mr. Snowden did as terrorism at all. You see, terrorism has a formal definition in our work, and that definition is that it uses violence, and primarily violence against non-military and usually non-government targets, in order to bring about some political change through the application of technology leverage. And so when you look at those kinds of systems, like the ones that were allegedly hacked by Mr. Snowden, or in the WikiLeaks case by Manning, what you have is a lack of violence, and therefore it doesn't qualify as terrorism. It's not intended to disrupt a non-governmental system, as most terrorism is. So I put those in a very different category.
But you see some of the cyber terrorism that we're talking about as an inherently violent act. Why?
Well, because the Stuxnet attack, which was built and launched by the United States and Israel against Iran, proved definitively for the first time, at least in the open source, that mere computer code could cause physical destruction. In the same way, there are all sorts of violent results that can come from cyber terrorism, not just simply the mangling of data or the disabling of computer systems, but you can imagine the death and destruction that might occur, for instance, from a sustained interruption to our electric grid. People depend on the electric grid for a wide variety of things, not the least of which is life support in hospitals. And so I view those as violent acts and not simply acts of political disobedience.
What is the domestic threat that you see from cyber terrorism?
The domestic threat is much more from disaffected groups, from homegrown terrorist groups that, for one reason or another, decide to exploit the methods of cyber terrorism for their own gains. We don't see a tremendous amount of that today, but because cyber is so easy to do, because it requires so little investment and it's so hard to track, we certainly expect that we'll see an increasing amount of the use of cyber leverage by homegrown groups in the same way that we've seen it coming from overseas.
Is there something that cyber terrorists need to be effective that it's hard for them to get? And I'm asking in this way because I think about traditional terrorists perhaps getting their hands on radioactive materials in order to make a dirty bomb or a certain type of chemicals to stage an attack. It's something that's easily traced by governments, and so therefore it's hard for people to get their hands on to stage an attack. Is there something similar in the cyber world that terrorists could use, but it's hard for them to obtain?
Unfortunately, no. The only things that they require are a relatively simple computer, a connection to the internet, and knowledge that is generally freely available on the internet for those who know where to look.
In the wake of last year's massive cyber attack on the retailer Target, the FBI director is trying to bridge the gap between the government and the private sector in combating some of this. What do you think is the role of the American private sector business in all of this?
Well, it's critical, certainly, because, as I said, 95% of all the computer systems in the country are not government-connected or government-controlled. Business has to step up. It has to recognize that it has an important and central role to play. It has to make the correct investments. What we learned and have learned about the Target attack is that they had the right systems, but their people were not trained to recognize the alarms when they went off. In fact, they ignored them. It's a lot like hitting the snooze button when the alarm wakes you up in the morning. And very often when you read articles about cyber, you will see a characterization of a particular attack as being a wake-up call. Unfortunately, here in the United States, we're really good at just rolling over and going back to sleep.
Well, if you could, just before I let you go, tell me more about that. I mean, what should we be more awake to than most of us are just sleeping through?
I think we need to be awake to the magnitude and type of threat that is constantly evolving. We need to take this seriously at the government level. We have been very slow to react because private industry has generally told our government, this is not your business, we'll take care of ourselves. And then time and time again, private industry has failed to do so. I think we need some standards that are set. I think we need to, as a population, acknowledge that there is a cost to protecting our systems and our way of life, and we need to have everybody step up and absorb that cost, not the least of which is that we as individuals need to take care of our own cyber cleanliness, if you will, learn some cyber hygiene. And that means using a password that is other than 123456, the most popular password in the world.
And that cost, if we were to really invest as a nation, what would it cost us really to get ourselves up to snuff?
Well, I'm afraid that it would cost us several tens of billions of dollars just to get started. But I think it's an investment we need to make.
Lawrence Husick is co-chairman of the Center for the Study of Terrorism at the Foreign Policy Research Institute. He's going to be speaking at the World Affairs Council of Connecticut in a conversation called Fighting Below the Belt, Global Cyber Terrorism. You can find out more at ctwac.org. Lawrence, thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it.
You're quite welcome. Thank you.
Where We Live is produced by Tucker Ives and Lydia Brown. The executive producer is Katie Tolarski. I'm John Dankosky. Thanks for joining us.